We will proceed to the fifth case, Lobson versus the United States. Michael.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is David Michael. I am the attorney for the appellant, Kim Lobson, and I am here with my co-counsel, Michael McDermott, a local attorney, Chicago. This is an appeal from the district court's denial of a motion to return property pursuant to 41G of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure and the equitable jurisdiction of the court regarding a seizure from my client back in September of 2003 of a substantial amount of U.S. currency, I would say. I don't know if the record's really clear to the court, but I want to make the note of it that there is no criminal proceedings that were ever involved with this case. My client was never charged with an offense. Nobody was ever charged with any kind of a criminal offense. This is simply a civil and actually administrative forfeiture proceeding. And the single issue in this case is really regarding the constitutional due process notice in administrative forfeiture proceedings and, of course, the application of this circuit's earlier decision in Garcia versus Meza back in 2000 to the specific facts of this particular case. Now, the overview of Garcia, just as a referral, is that as all the other courts in the Supreme Court have dealt with the concept of adequate notice in seizure cases when property is taken by an administrative agency, and there is no dispute regarding what that initial notice must be and what that initial notice requires to satisfy constitutional due process concerns. Garcia went a little bit further, and not in a unique way, because there, I think every single circuit that has addressed the issue of when you go a little bit further after you have this adequate notice, what really you should do when certain circumstances intervene. And the circumstances that intervene in Garcia, as in the other circuits, was what happens if subsequent events show that the initial notice by the government, which was adequate when you examine it pursuant to constitutional concerns, becomes inadequate when something happens that makes that notice ineffective or unsatisfactory. And the Garcia court held that if the government knows of or learns that the initial notice, which was adequate at the time it was sent, was not received by the person who had to receive that notice, somehow not received, then the burdens on the government to make a reasonable effort to provide additional notice so that that person can't...
Well, they made an effort. They spoke to her lawyer or his lawyer. Is it he?
Well...
Were you the lawyer that the government spoke to or someone else?
I was not. What happened is that after the seizure on September the 3rd, a month later, a DEA agent by the name of Ken Pavilla called the claimant and left a message for her saying, I'm the agent, I'm involved in this case, here's my telephone number. 3 days later, Ms. Lobson's attorney, whose name is John Conroy, before he called me and got me involved in the case, called the DEA agent back 3 days later on October the 6th, advised him who he was. He was the attorney representing Ms. Lobson, and this is just a message. He did not actually personally speak to him. Gave him his number and all the contact of him, saying that he wanted to be advised regarding notice to Ms. Lobson. Okay? So what happens is that these agencies generally have a significant period of time in which to provide notice. I think that the rules that relate to the DEA provide not only for a 90-day notice period, but I think they even can get within the internal agency, give themselves an additional 30, 60, or 90 days if they want to do that, depending upon what they consider to be their investigative duties. Mr. Conroy waited, and then by December 22nd, his client was telling him she still had not received notice. He then called the agent, who was the contact agent for the case, and advised him once again in a message that his client had not received actual notice of the seizure from the Drug Enforcement Administration. The agent called back 1 week later on December 29th and responded to Mr. Conroy's message by leaving a message for Mr. Conroy saying, well, I've investigated that. She received notice on November the 8th. But Mr. Conroy's call to the agent was 2 weeks before the agency administratively forfeited the property.
I understand. So the agent called Conroy on the 29th, left a message. So what did Conroy do?
Well, the agent called Conroy and left a message that said that she had received notice on November 8th.
What did Conroy do when he received the message?
What Conroy did is he called back and he told him. Conroy called him back on January the 7th.
Too late.
Too late for what?
Too late. The forfeiture had occurred.
The forfeiture occurred 2 weeks after Conroy advised the agent that his client had not received notice.
Was it January 5th that it became final?
Right. Well, there's no way for Mr. Conroy to know when the government would affect a forfeiture of the money.
Why didn't he call back December 29th or December 30th?
Well, you know, A, that is the holiday season, so we can presume that maybe he wasn't available at that time. Why did the agent call back the same day? But really,
doesn't check his phone messages? He closes up Christmas or something?
Isn't really the critical constitutional issue here, Your Honor?
No, I think whether or not... The critical issue is they certainly provided adequate notice in the usual way. They get a return receipt. They assume notice is fine. And if something's wrong, right, December 29th call, the agent tells Conroy that, you know, everything's fine, gave them notice and all that. So you'd think that Conroy would really have to get off his tail and move on this because he knows that, you know, clock is running and so on.
There's nothing other than the fact that on the 22nd, the administrative agency was put on notice that Ms. Lobson had
put on notice business. For all we know, she did receive the original notice perfectly well. All we know is that she claims not to have received it, even though the government, you know, got its receipt back. So it seems to me in those circumstances, the lawyer for the person whose property is being forfeited has a duty to act with expedition.
If you have those circumstances, Your Honor, there's nothing a person can do to try to establish that she did not receive actual notice. Because if the government is relying on merely the fact that the notice was sent and there's a return receipt, and there could be all kinds of problems regarding that return receipt, then what can a person do? Can Conroy call him back up and say...
I understand all that problems with a return receipt. Usually a return receipt is extremely good evidence.
In fact, that return receipt, if the agency would have bothered to look at it, indicates that, in fact, that was not Ms. Lobson's signature on that return receipt. For all we know, it could have been delivered to another town.
It's a scribble.
Or it could have been delivered to another house or another apartment in the same complex. We don't know that.
Why would someone sign for it in another house?
But isn't it constitutionally mandated, and I would suggest it is, that in fact...
All that's required by the Constitution is that they make reasonable efforts, the government, to notify. So, you know, I think that call on December 29th was a reasonable effort, and that government didn't have to sit around waiting weeks for the person to return the phone call.
Your Honor, I would submit that it's constitutionally impermissible for the government to rely on that once, pursuant to Garcia, they receive notice that she, in fact, did not receive that notice.
I don't believe it. We don't know whether she received that notice or not. We don't know who signed that or whether she signed it with a scribble or what.
Your Honor, I see the light is on. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Michael. Ms. Rychek.
May it please the Court. The District Court correctly recognized that due process was served in this case. The DEA gave Ms. Lobson notice by certified mail at her address, and that notice was returned as having been delivered to that address. Special Agent Pavlina did get a call from Mr. Conroy on December 22nd, returned it a week later, and told Mr. Conroy that notice had been served at Ms. Lobson's address on November 3rd. Nothing more happened until Special Agent Pavlina himself contacted Mr. Conroy
again. Why did the Canadian attorney call the DEA?
Why did he call DEA on the 29th?
The first call he made. What prompted that call?
According to his affidavit, he contacted Special Agent Pavlina to say that no notice had been received.
Just So that was, it was just what he thought, time had passed and no notice was received, that was the theory?
Apparently, that's what the affidavit says, and that's all we have to go on in this case. And also, just for the record, there was actually a conversation between...
Do we have anything from Ms. Lobson?
Yes, she also submitted an affidavit below stating that she apparently was in communication with Mr. Conroy numerous times during that period. However, the record only reflects one communication between Mr. Conroy and Special Agent Pavlino, or anyone with DEA for that matter, after the notice was delivered on November 3rd. So what we have here is DEA was responding to the inquiries made by Ms. Lobson's attorney and was providing as much information as he could, and nothing happened until Special Agent Pavlina himself made the effort to communicate with Mr. Conroy again.
What did the original receipt that you received, did that say anything about any how long the process would take or anything of that nature?
It did indicate that if she had any questions about this matter, she should contact the Agency Forfeiture Council in Alexandria, Virginia. There is no information in the record that indicates that that ever happened until after the forfeiture had already occurred on January 5th. For some reason, she elected to communicate with Special Agent Pavlina here in Chicago instead.
What was the time frame from when the money was seized until the Canadian attorney called?
The money was seized on September 5th, and the Canadian attorney called on December 22nd. So there was a fair amount of time in between.
How did she know the money had been seized? Was she there?
Yes, it was seized from her.
From her purse?
Yes, at Union Station. It was in plastic heat-sealed packages. If the members of the panel have any further questions, I would be more than happy to answer them. If not, then we will simply ask that you affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Michael?
First, Your Honor, is the fact that the money was seized on September the 3rd, but in October, after Agent Pavilla called Ms. Lobson 3 days later on October 6th, Attorney Conroy called back to Lobson and advised him of his representation, and that he was awaiting notice at that time. So it wasn't until December; it was in October that he spoke to him. So he had a feeling, a reasonable feeling, that when the notice would be given, that he would find out about notice himself. You know, because he
pretty
advised
lackadaisical. I mean, you think you'd want to get your money back pretty quickly before it disappears into the Treasury.
Well, I've done hundreds of forfeiture cases, and I don't think it's lackadaisical, Your Honor. I think what in fact happens is that you are powerless until the DEA gives you notice. The only thing you could possibly do is file what we call a throwaway motion, a motion in federal court for the return of the property. But once the DEA initiates their notice, then that motion becomes moot and the courts can't rule on it. So you really can only effectively wait until the DEA gives their notice, and we know that they've got a certain amount of time to do that. And that's why he waited, and when he waited the 3 months and there wasn't a notice, at least again, he called him again. So that's two calls to him.
Mr. Michael, when you have what you call the throwaway motion, but that does establish contact with the government, does it not, with an assistant United States attorney? You do have some capacity to track or monitor, do you not, the DEA's process?
Not much, but back in the old days, the DEA didn't have it really quite together when forfeiture started to become very popular, maybe about 10 years ago, and there are a lot of mistakes made in terms of the process. Now the DEA has really got their process locked in. Okay, they take it, they give the notice, they wait till they get the claim back, and then the matter is then transferred to the U.S. attorney in the district where the property is seized for the initiation of judicial proceedings. You know, and I would like to tell the court also that these are very, very simple little procedures. I mean, the notice is a simple little one-page document that goes out from the agency. The claim is just as simple. All it is just a piece of paper, a single-page paper where the person says they have a claim or interest in the money. They verify their signature. They send it off to the DEA. But the documents are extremely critical. The claim cannot be filed with the DEA or the administrative agency until they have actually the physical notice, because you don't know what you're claiming, and you don't even know if you're doing it within the federal rules or the CFRs that control what you have to do. So all it is a simple one-day process. If the agent would have just given him, in that two-week period before the forfeiture occurred, just given him a copy, faxed him a copy of the notice, whatever it was, he could have immediately filed a claim on her behalf, and that has an astronomical effect when you file that claim. It sends that case to the U.S. government, U.S. attorney, and then you're in a judicial forum, which, of course, really is the second prong of due process, the opportunity to be heard. So the consequences are very, very significant, even though the work that the government has to do, and the court even said in Garcia, it's not a burden on the court to just give them another copy of that notice once they become aware that that notice was not received.
What would happen if the forfeiture were set aside?
We'd just be back at square one. What happens in those, and there's precedent for that, is if the district court sets aside the administrative forfeiture, then the district court can order the governmental agency to initiate the notice process again. She can file the claim. It goes back to the U.S. attorney. It doesn't guarantee that she's going to win any of the money back, but at least she'll have a forum in which she can raise all of the issues that she has a right to raise and have an opportunity to be heard. That's all that will happen. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Thank you to the government. The case is taken under advisement. And